You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show do not reflect the opinions of KUCI, its management, or the regents of the University of California. Welcome to In the Garden with University of California Master Gardeners. I'm Tina Spindler, a UC Master Gardener, and the host of today's program. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that is really important to all of us in this time of terrible drought, and I have a great guest with us today from the University of California South Coast Research Center and Cooperative Extension in Irvine, Dr. Darren Haver. Hi, Darren. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Tina. Thank you for the invitation to come talk to you today about the drought.
Yeah, we're in a pretty bad fix at the current time, and I know that you've done as the water resources and quality advisor for the Orange County Cooperative Extension and Research Station, you've done yourself a lot of research on water conservation and quality, so that's what we'd like to talk about today.
Great.
But before we get started, I know as I'm a master gardener and I am part of the program that is housed by the Cooperative Extension in Orange County, I thought maybe it would be a good idea to take a minute and just orient the listeners as to what the research station and the Cooperative Extension are. Can you do that for us?
Great. I will try to do that in a really short, succinct manner. It can be a little complex, but I'll do my best. So the Research and Extension Centers, there are nine of them located across the state of California. They are managed by UC Ag and Natural Resources, and that is a division of the University of California that has been around for many, many, many years. We're closely associated with the original ag campuses, which are UC Berkeley, UC Davis, and UC Riverside. So we do partner quite a bit with them, but we're also partnering with some of the other UC schools as well as UC Merced and some of the other ones that are located in various counties throughout the state of California. So South Coast Research and Extension Center, located here in Irvine, California, is actually one of the nine research centers that are used by our academics to look at some of their research that they may have developed on campus, and now they're looking to take that research out into the field and test it in different environments. And we, as stated in the title of it, we are the South Coast Center, so we do work in an area that's located close to the coast in Southern California.
So what can you tell us a little bit about some of the research projects that have happened here in the past and what you have going on currently?
Sure. South Coast Research and Extension Center has been around since 1956. Originally, the research center was put in place to do work on tropical and subtropical fruits, as well as, believe it or not, originally planned an area to do work on ornamental plants, which, as we know now, with the development around this particular area, that's a really critical area of research that needs to be done. The research initially was focusing on the strawberry breeding program, avocado breeding, as well as looking at alternatives more recently to the traditional pesticides. So we do a lot of integrated pest management work, as well as we like looking at various levels of water quality and water conservation practices in both agriculture as well as in urban landscape issues.
Now, I've heard a rumor that most of the strawberries that we currently buy in the supermarket, a lot of them were developed here, those varieties.
There are a number of patents that were developed here in Irvine in conjunction with UC Davis. Their work is done both in Northern and Southern California. That program was located here in Southern California up until November last year. Most of the strawberry production is moving up the coast. As most people know, in Orange County, there is very little agriculture left, but there's still a few little pockets here and there. And so we will probably be doing some of the local research, but maybe not so much of the breeding program will be done here at this location.
But I know one of my favorite projects that I've seen here was your project that was done a number of years ago, which now is turning out to be so important to all of us. And so can you tell us a little bit about the residential water research program that you did right here on this site?
Definitely. I started a project in the mid-2005, 2006. My original research and extension focused on working with agriculture in the Irvine-Newport Bay watershed area. But as the agriculture left, we started to see some of the issues that we were targeting with agriculture, such as pesticides and nutrients in runoff. We started also seeing and detecting that in the streams and creeks where we just had urban runoff occurring. So I had this thought of trying to figure out, you know, how are these things being mobilized from their point of application around a home, and how is it getting out into the storm drains and then on out into our urban creeks and then ultimately to the ocean. I wanted to see what was going on there. What was the mechanism? We had some ideas, but there wasn't a lot of research that had actually looked at that. At the same time, I wanted to be able to develop something that provided some area where people could have information provided to them, mainly the general public as well as professionals that work in the urban landscape sector. So we developed these simulated homes, and they basically are prefab garages that serve as the house, for the footprint. And then we scaled the landscapes to be similar to the house size. So the footprint of each of the landscapes is very similar in scale to what you would find in a typical Southern California residential landscape.
They look just like little houses, even though no one lives there.
Exactly. And that's the point. We actually utilize the footprint of those houses for instructional purposes. So the inside of those rooms are set as classrooms. We do lots of trainings with our master gardeners because that's our outreach to the general public. And so we need to make sure they have the latest information. But we've also used them for professional landscapers, architects, development companies that want to come in and learn some things about the urban landscape. Maybe they know a lot about building a home, but not so much about the landscapes around them. So we're seeing more and more interest on that. Although that project was started as a water quality project, we quickly realized that everything we were doing to improve water quality and reduce surface runoff obviously was related to also reducing water use around the landscape.
Yeah.
So better irrigation, so you didn't have surface runoff, also reduced the amount of water you were using on your landscape, making sure that water landed on the plant material rather than on half the plant material and then on the sidewalk and the driveway. All of those things that go hand in hand, and then as the drought has proceeded over the last few years, we've continued to do that research and now started looking at just how much water are these landscapes using.
So can you tell us, I know there are three different pretend houses and
Correct.
Three different landscapes, which are real landscapes.
Correct.
And can you tell us, describe to us what the type of landscape is that you installed on each of those
Sure.
and what you've discovered as a result of
Absolutely.
Installing those?
So we have our first landscape, or what we call is our landscape A, or our typical landscape. It is modeled after what we see most commonly used around Southern California, as well as other parts of California. We've done some research in Sacramento, and houses look very, very similar, and the design very similar. And the footprint is basically turf grass in the front and the back, a lot of hardscape where you allow a lot of the water that falls on the landscape to run off out to the street. And you have plant material that typically is considered to be high water user. And then you have very, very poor irrigation. That was sort of our typical landscape scenario, and it was a worst-case scenario in a sense. But it wasn't something that couldn't be fixed without completely redoing the landscape. Then we had a second landscape that was, you know, if you had decided to retrofit that first landscape and wanted to actually put in something different, something that used less water, new irrigation, that's how that particular landscape is designed. And we have... It's changed over the years. I mean, it's now getting, I was thinking about this yesterday. They were installed in 2006, 2007. We're now, you know, almost 7-8 years into this project. And so the landscapes are maturing, and there's some things that need to be modified and changed. As well, there's a lot of new technology out there that we would like to showcase. So that middle landscape has all those improvements, plus the idea is to allow water to infiltrate into the soil and recharge groundwater. That's not always possible. In certain areas, you want to be very careful with that. If you have shallow groundwater, and you don't, then you don't want to be using a lot of chemicals and fertilizers that can contaminate the groundwater. So we try to focus and educate people very specifically on that. Then the last landscape is very close to a 100% California native landscape. There are a few non-natives in there, but the idea in that landscape was to remove all the turf grass and go to something completely different. A lot of people like to call that the kind of the empty nester design, where you don't need the turf anymore because you don't have kids that are home playing, and maybe you just don't want to manage mowing the lawn and fertilizing the lawn and watering the lawn. And so that one is just the third landscape that provides more of a California native environment.
So can you tell us two things mainly. So first of all, since we're in this drought and people are really focused on water use, can you tell us a little bit about how much water each of those three types of landscapes use?
Sure. I can give you a rough estimate. So one of the issues with the project that we put it in, it was not focusing on water use.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were looking at more what was running off the landscape. So we've sort of, in fact, right now we're actually revising some of our monitoring equipment so we can get a better handle on how much each landscape is using. But under poor irrigation systems, you know, the first landscape, your typical one, can consume quite a bit of water. And I think that most people are starting to see that in their billing statements and a lot of the newspaper articles that talk about how much water is used outside. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we've done such a great job of reducing the water use inside that a greater percentage now is being used outside. And of course, that varies from house to house, person to person. But on average, you know, you can get up to 50, 60, even higher amount of percent of your water being used outside to maintain whatever you have. So in our worst case scenario where we had irrigation running every day, regardless of any kind of situation, we were using on average running, and this is a daily average. Some days we didn't obviously have this much water, but it can be upwards of 700, 800 gallons of water or one CCF. That's a lot of water, and that would be a worst case scenario. And if you were a water user such as that nowadays, your bill would be very, very significant. And you would know that. But what we wanted to do was create something where we could show people, if you've got that really poor irrigation and poor scheduling, what could you do immediately to fix that?
And when you say poor irrigation, tell us what that meant. What kind of systems were you using?
So the spray heads, where you have pop-ups, which is very common. The spray heads typically can put out over 1.5 inches of water an hour. And so you think about the timing that you leave on your sprinkler, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. If you do that every day in all your zones that you have, all your irrigation valves run that long, you can see how that would add up very, and depending on how many sprinkler heads, every head is putting out 1.5 gallons an hour. So that could be significant and adds up very, very quickly. The other part of that poor portion is that a lot of times that water doesn't fall on the plant material. So some of it's falling on the sidewalk or the driveway. It's very difficult to target water directly to plant material, especially if you've got a very a design of a landscape that has a lot of curves, a lot of narrow areas. Very difficult to irrigate with just regular pop-up spray heads. And so that's that scenario. But if you have that and you don't have the money to, you know, completely redo your landscape, you can just go back to that irrigation system and work on improving those sprinklers, making sure that every single one of the sprinkler heads is the same manufacturer and putting out the same amount of water. A lot of people don't have that because they've over the years they've gone into their garage, and I remember having a box, and I still have that box in my garage that has every broken sprinkler or part that I've ever had. I throw it into a box because I may need it later, and I don't want to have to run down to the local box store to find the part. So you just try to fix things as quick as you can and grab whatever sprinkler. But what you generally end up with is different manufacturers, different amounts of water coming out. And that makes it very difficult to go back to your clock and turn it on and schedule for 10 minutes. If they're putting out different amounts of water in 10 minutes, some areas of your yard may be getting too much water and some may be not getting enough. And so you really should make sure that you invest some money in actually making sure the delivery system, the sprinklers themselves, are working. Then backtrack to your clock and look at how old your clock is. Are you able to kind of manage that clock in a way that allows you to run short amount of times? If you get runoff very quickly, you don't want to have really long run times, you know, 10, 15 minutes. If runoff occurs in 2 minutes, you want those sprinklers to turn off in 2 minutes and allow the water to soak into the soil.
Yeah, well, let's get back to the steps we can take in a little bit.
Okay.
If we can go and continue to focus on the different systems that you used in the three different landscapes, I think that'll give us all kind of a background as to what the different alternatives are, and then we can drill down on specific things people can do if they have one of those types of landscapes.
So the middle landscape, or our retrofit landscape, looked at reducing the turf size, and that was a way that we could not use so much water on turf, and then shifting from what we call cool season turf grass to warm season turf grass.
Oh.
Warm season turf grass uses less water in the summer. It does not, it doesn't mind the really high temperatures. It has a really deep, extensive root system, so it can capitalize on more water in the soil. We improved the irrigation system. Instead of controlling it just with a clock, we added in soil moisture sensors, which allowed the irrigation system to kind of check the soil moisture level and determine if irrigation needed to occur.
Oh, interesting. So soil moisture
sensors.
So
actually looking at the soil. There are other ways that work, but that one is a really good way that you can actually sense what the plant roots are actually sensing. You still have to have a little bit of information. We can talk about that later as far as, you know, what you need to know in order to properly utilize a soil moisture sensor.
Right.
All the plant material shifted more from the high water tropical plant material, or you know, everybody, a lot of people like European white birch trees, and a lot of people have them in their yards, but you should know that that's a tree that needs water, usually grows near a creek or a stream in its native habitat. So you need to provide that water for that particular kind of tree. So we switched from those types to trees that are used to having a little less water during the summertime. And so a lot of the California natives will serve that purpose. And there's other parts of the world, Mediterranean climates, that have trees that can work as well. So that's the other big focus, was on the plant material.
Plant material.
And then we added in a few other what we call low-impact development strategies, which allow for water to infiltrate and stay on site. So instead of it running off the driveway, it actually is allowed to run into a planter area, providing more water for that plant material.
Oh, great.
Then the third landscape, we used a slightly different irrigation controller, which is known as a smart controller, something that uses the current weather and is able to adjust the irrigation system based on that. Those are very popular, lots of rebates available for those. They work very well as long as you have a good delivery system. So we'll go back to that original thing I was talking about, where making sure that your irrigation system is working well before you switch to a clock like that. That is a native landscape. Again, plant material going a little bit more extreme to almost all California natives. And I'm talking about California natives that are locally adapted. You want to be really careful when you do that, because there's lots of parts and climates in California that you could create a landscape that is almost a rainforest. If you want to go, if you know the redwoods up in the Eureka coastal area,
yeah,
a lot more water there than down here. So you want it to basically mimic a lot of what you're seeing around in the Chaparral area. And you can do that very nicely if you choose your plants correctly and have a nice-looking landscape. You don't have to have the dry brush in the middle of the summer. And I think we've shown that. You do have to provide a little bit of additional water to keep some of the plants from going dormant. Some of them do not want any summer water, and you want to make sure you refrain completely. But such plants as the California sycamore, that's another plant that's used to being next to streams, and so it looks a lot better when it gets a little bit more water. And that becomes very important when we talk about drought situations, on what plants you're going to provide the little bit of water that you're going to be provided as we go deeper and deeper to this drought.
Yeah, and I've obviously seen all three of these landscapes, and I have to tell you, I am not a big fan of the first one, even though it's what we all grew up with. It is very uninteresting.
It's very green.
It's very green, but it's very bland, and it has not a lot of visual interest.
Although anecdotal information, working in those landscapes for the last 7-8 years, you do see a difference in the wildlife that comes to that landscape. You are going to have more birds, butterflies, et cetera, coming to landscapes that have more food sources for them. So that is something you definitely can see just walking between those three landscapes. And we haven't collected any data on it, but when people do work out there on a weekly basis, they do comment on that quite regularly.
That's interesting. So you plant the native plants, and all of a sudden you have the native species.
Absolutely.
Hanging out in
yeah.
the garden.
You provide nectar for a lot of those birds and butterflies. They will be there.
That's an added bonus.
Added
to
bonus,
to saving water.
I think that's an added bonus for most people.
Yeah. So let me ask you again to just let everyone know. I know that you have an open house once
Correct.
A year in the fall, because I know listening to this, I'm stimulated again to want to go out and see those. And because this is a research station, it's not open to the public
Correct.
Every day, because you have to control the conditions for research. But you do have a great open house once a year. So can you tell listeners a little bit about that so they can know when
I'd
to
love
come
to.
See this?
Yeah, I'd love to. We started, I'm trying to think of when, we're on either our 7th or 8th. The first one year that we did this open house, it was part of a research project. And the idea was to provide education to a set group of people that we were working with, set group of residents. And then see if providing that education actually allowed them to go back to their homes and make changes. And then while they were making those changes, we were downstream collecting water from the runoff from the neighborhood. They didn't know that we were doing that, but we wanted to see if we could actually improve water quality by doing that.
Yeah.
So that was a project we did several years ago, and that type of outreach actually works really well for people, as long as you give people things that they can do pretty easily. We have a lot of things that we showcase here. Some of them can be costly, and so you have to run the gamut. I love to have things that people can leave that day after they've come to the open house and go home and make those changes. This year we have the event on September 26th. It is an open house. You don't have to sign up. We open the doors at 9 and we close at 2. You can come stay for 5-10 minutes, get the information you need and leave, or you can stay a little bit longer and listen to some of the lectures that we have going on. We have many of the vendors that we work with, and we test a lot of their equipment here on site. They will be here. We don't do any sales or sell any types of things, because you can't buy anything when you come here, controller-wise. But it's a place for you to come and look at them, ask some questions. We have some really wonderful master gardeners that have worked with the project for many, many years. They can answer any question about plants in the landscape, problems you may be having. We can show you all our warts and problems that we have, because we're not, it's not perfect. So we learn a lot by just growing the plants here. We have the ability to have some of the vendors actually will demonstrate some of their products. So if you're going to be replacing sprinklers, for instance, they will show you exactly how to do that. And then you can run to the box store that day, get what you need, and go home and be able to do that.
I think that is huge for me, because I know, you know, I'm not particularly mechanical, and running to the box store and trying to figure out on my own what it is I need is problematic.
Yeah.
But to be able to come here first and talk to the manufacturers and the vendors and find
Absolutely.
Out how things work and what I need is just a huge benefit. So that's a great advantage for folks if they come.
It's one of the main things that, and the reason why I have this and we do this open house is because I really do want people to be able to get some information and feel like when they go to purchase something that they're armed with the scientific-based information that we have available. We do our best to have as much as we can available as far as information-wise, but we have not tested everything. Or even looked at a lot of the new technology, especially in the last 6 months. There's been so many things coming out that a lot of companies are trying out new things, all kinds of ways of saving water. And because that wasn't our original focus of this research project, we're in the middle of doing some modifications to the landscape. So one of the things we hope to do is demo some subsurface irrigation so that eliminates all worry about evaporation when you turn the sprinklers
yeah.
on, as well as should reduce any surface runoff that you might get. That's very nice when you're talking very narrow median strips that a lot of us have out in front of our houses that are difficult to irrigate.
Yeah, those old-time medium strips, yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, the other thing that I like about it is the timing, particularly this year, as people are being encouraged to switch their planting material from
Correct.
High water use to low water use, and doing it in the dead of summer is just not a good idea.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we've made a number of those. I will say that we've made those bad choices in an effort to have things installed for September when we're ready to have our open house. And they usually don't go well.
Uh-huh.
It requires a lot of extra water. Most of those plants, they're obviously not drought tolerant yet until they're in the ground and are able to have some root growth. And that usually can sometimes take two seasons where you have to provide something, some kind of supplemental irrigation. If we get good winter rains, that's the ideal situation. When I first installed the third landscape we were talking about earlier, the California landscape, I did that in the winter of 2007. And I planted all the plants in December and January, and I believe we got 2.5 inches of rain that year, roughly.
Oh, awesome. Oh, only
two and a half
oh,
inches
no.
that whole season. It was a really low, it was a drought year for us, one
oh,
of the
wow.
first ones. And so we've had a couple ups and downs since then that have supplemented that, but that was a really low rainfall year. That was not enough to get those native plants established. And so we had to provide some supplemental irrigation, and a lot of my research data in the beginning was showing that the native landscape was using more water than some of the others. But that's because we had to provide that supplemental. Now, basically, if you look at the numbers, there's only supplemental irrigation I apply to the California native landscape is to the sycamore tree that looks much better, as well as I have an area covered with a sedge grass. And the sedge grass is a marsh grass that does well under wet conditions, so it does really well in the winter. It can go dormant in the summer, which was fine if some people like that, but if they don't want it to go dormant, you got to provide a little bit of extra water for it. And so besides that, all the other plant material does not need any supplemental during the wintertime. Or, in fact, in the summertime, I think we've only done 2 sprinkler applications so far.
Wow. But it's really good for people to hear, though, that your keeping track of the water that you used when you first planted them showed that you were using as much water as a traditional landscape.
Absolutely.
Because I think a lot of folks that I've heard as a master gardener when I'm out talking about, you know, switching to natives or drought-tolerant plants, people are disappointed and they'll say they've had bad experiences because they have
sure,
died.
Yeah.
But what they don't realize is that first year or two, as you said,
Absolutely.
you can't treat them by not watering them. You have to give them supplemental water.
And I think the other thing we noticed is going into a somewhat established landscape and, you know, putting in some new plants here and there, you've got to depend on the irrigation for your regular plants, but the new plants you're putting in that maybe that same irrigation zone are not going to be using the same amount of water. So you may think you may be able to back off a lot, but if you put a couple new plants in that same irrigation area, you might have to provide some supplemental. And my suggestion is not running that whole zone for, you know, extra time is actually going out there with either a hose or a bucket and providing a little bit of extra water.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what I do at my house. I have a bucket that I hand water with those particular, and I may do it. I just did some plantings in this spring. I'm hoping we were going to get some more rains, but I've just been taking a bucket on a weekly basis on the weekend and supplementing those plants, and they seem to be doing just fine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. You don't want to run the whole station.
No, you
because
definitely
then
don't want to do that.
You're going to harm the plants that don't want that much water.
And then
water.
You're going to be using a lot of excess water where you don't need to.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So tell us the date and the time again.
So it's September 26th this year from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Again, come anytime. It can be quite crowded at times. We try to do our best job with parking and making sure people have a place to be. You might have to do a little bit of walking to the actual event if there's a lot of people here, but I encourage you all to come out. It's definitely worth it. You should leave here with some great information.
And you mentioned that there would be some talks or seminars. Can you tell us a little bit about what those will cover?
We are just now actually determining who the speakers are going to be, but the topics will be addressing drought issues, irrigation issues, really honing in on the things that people want to know when they leave here. You know, how do I program my controller properly? How do I plant the correct kind of plants? It will be things that you definitely will want to know if you're in the middle of redoing your landscape.
Awesome, awesome. Well, we're going to take just a moment to identify ourselves. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And a reminder that the opinions expressed on this show do not reflect the opinions of KUCI, its management, or the regents of the University of California. Okay. So cool that we now know what all is done out here, some really exciting past and current research projects. Can you tell me just a little bit, even though I already know, about how the cooperative extension arm that exists out here, of which Master Gardeners are a part, tell us what our purpose is in the cooperative extension. What's our mission?
Absolutely. So I think one of the neat things about South Coast Research and Extension Center is it's located in Orange County. Every county in California has a UC Cooperative Extension office that is the outreach arm of the University of California. And we pride ourselves on our ability to take basic research and some applied research and actually take it out to the end user. We have several programs. Originally, I should say, Cooperative Extension in Orange County was located at the Orange County Fair. We have since relocated everybody here to South Coast Research and Extension Center. So that being our various programs, we have a foods and nutrition program that consists of our federal FNEP program, which is the Expanded Foods and Nutrition Educational Program. That's one component. We have another component, which is our 4-H Youth Development Program, which is, as it says, a youth development program. Then we have our Master Gardener program, which is one of our largest volunteer programs right after the 4-H program as far as number of trained volunteers that are out there. Really proud of that particular group and the work that they do. I work very closely with them, obviously, from some of the work that I do with water conservation and water quality. We have an environmental horticulture program that also oversees the Master Gardener program, focuses a lot on various professionals that are working in the urban landscape area. We just recently had a retirement in that area. Our advisor, John Kabashima, who's been with us for 28 years, has retired. He's going to be difficult for him to leave. He's going to still be around to help us because he's a font full of information, and we love to have him around. But we will be replacing him with, they don't like to use the word replace, but there is a new position, environmental horticulture position, that's split between San Diego County and Orange County. So that person will be helping oversee the Master Gardener program, as well as working with me on various horticultural issues.
And in case our listeners don't know what that person does, they are critical in identifying invasive pests, which we always seem to be having new problems with, and providing the information or doing the research to figure out how to control those. So I know it's something that we I'm sad to see John retire because he's just been so involved in all of that.
Yes, he has been involved in all that, and we'll definitely miss him, but he's promised that he will be around to help us when we need it, and I'm sure we will need some assistance.
Good, that's good.
The advisors' jobs that work for the county, the Cooperative Extension Office, their job is to do some research, some applied research, as well as create a lot of extension outreach, conduct workshops, train our volunteers, make sure that people have as much scientific-based information as they possibly can. They may be an expert in a particular area, but they are asked to have quite a bit of broad knowledge about a lot of things in that area. And so if they don't have that particular knowledge, that we have a network that we utilize through the campuses themselves as well as other advisors. And what we also have on campus are called cooperative extension specialists. They as well are part of that network. And so we can solve, I think, almost any problem that's thrown our way.
Absolutely. And just to let the listeners know, as we do on every show, the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners of Orange County have a website, uccemg.com, and there is a ton of information on that website that the university provides, and it is also a great place to learn about what's going on in the community, where we're holding some talks or some seminars or just having a day booth at a fun event like the Orange County Fair coming up. So I just want to thank Darren and all the other folks at the Cooperative Extension and the Research Center, because as a Master Gardener volunteer, knowing that we have these resources to get answers to any question that we get asked by the public is just huge for us to feel confident that we're doing a good job when we're out in the public.
Right.
So let's get back to providing some good information on this drought.
Okay.
So confusing, I know, just for my neighbors and folks that I see when I'm out doing a little public speaking. It's really confusing for them because they know that they need to save water, but they have this investment, you know, usually a pretty substantial investment in their landscape.
Absolutely.
They also have this emotional attachment to their lawns, and so we're really having to have an educational process to show them alternatives that are even more beautiful, I think. And actually,
right.
I've given a couple talks lately, and when you show them the pictures on a PowerPoint presentation, they just all of a sudden say, oh my gosh, I'd much rather have that landscape than my green lawn.
Mm-hmm,
So I think our being able to do some outreach into the community and show them that there are some really nice alternatives.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point, Tina.
It's huge.
Examples go a long ways, and I'm seeing more and more cities in their common areas or medians putting in examples that are good examples that people say, hey, though that plant material does look pretty good. It doesn't have to be grass. I can use something else.
Yeah, and then the other thing that I've been finding people are really grabbing onto is, as you mentioned earlier, if you can give them some strategies that they can take home to do today that don't cost them a huge amount of money, because a lot of people just don't have the money to rip out their irrigation or their landscapes.
But
can you tell a little bit more about, you mentioned it briefly, about things that they can do to their controllers, to their sprinkler watering times, to their sprinkler heads, not maybe ripping out the whole system, but doing. So if you can go through some of those quick, easy, and less expensive alternatives, that'd be awesome.
And I definitely like to preface it by saying that irrigation is difficult. it's difficult to keep it running at its optimum all the time. There are going to be times where a sprinkler breaks or it's clogged, or you just don't seem like the plants look that good. And so you've got to make adjustments. And that's probably the hardest thing that people have. We have a certain segment of society that has time and wants to spend time doing and working with that. And then there's the majority of us who, you know, we leave for work every day, and we just, when we come home, if everything looks green and great, you're good. And then, you know, now we're going to start some of that. That was fine before, but now you're going to get that bill that shows up, and it's like, oh my goodness, I think I'm using too much water.
Yeah.
Or it's just going to cost you more. And so you might be spending a little bit more time with that irrigation system. So some of the things I started to suggest earlier is, number one, you want to make sure that the delivery system, so where the water is coming out of the system, how does it work? Is it working well? Is it providing good coverage? There are elaborate methods that scientists use and professional irrigators use to determine that. It's not necessary for a homeowner to do that. If you're interested in that and you want to get involved in the math and in the design of irrigation, lots of resources available to you. But my first suggestion is just make sure that you regularly turn on your irrigation system when you're home and look at it. See what it's doing.
That's huge.
Most of us have it on early in the morning, which is what you should be doing, because you want to reduce the amount of evaporation evaporation that occurs and the winds and those kind of things. So it's correct to have it on early in the morning. It's just that we tend to not see it. We either see it after it's done. But if you leave for work and you realize and you look out and you say, wow, the sidewalk's really wet or the driveway's really wet, you want to go back to your irrigation system as soon as you can to see what's going on. Is something broken? Are the sprinklers turned slightly wrong? Are they just overspraying and you need better application? Is the pressure too high? When you turn it on, is there a lot of misting? Is it feel like you're at the, at a restaurant in Palm Springs and there's just mist going on? You don't want that kind of irrigation. You want larger droplets that can fall on the plant material. And so the first thing you can do is look at those sprinklers that you have and consider taking them and exchanging them for something that's more low precipitation, which means it's going to put out less water. I mentioned earlier that some of the regular sprinklers put out 1.5 to maybe 2 inches of water an hour. Low precipitation sprinklers put out less than that, somewhere around maybe a little over a half an inch to maybe an inch, depending on the models that you use and the pressure you're running it at.
Would those be what are called the rotating sprinklers?
Generally, those are called the rotating, yeah. And there's several of the big manufacturers have versions of those, so you should be easily be able to find those. And most of our water districts are rebating those. They can be a little bit more costly, but most of that coverage is covered by your water district in rebates. So I would consider that as probably your first plan of action. What you need to be aware of is that when you make that switch, you're going to have to also go back to your, if you have a clock, and you're going to have to make changes to your runtime. So if your plants need, a certain amount of water over time to get the water into the soil, and you don't make an adjustment to that schedule, before you were in an hour, you were putting on 1.5 to 2 inches, and now you're putting on half that. That half might not be enough for your plants. So
right. You
need to keep that in mind. Most of the times the water districts, when they put together sample watering schedules for you, you will find a little asterisk somewhere, hopefully, that basically gives you the scenario that they have. And it's usually that you're using sprinklers of 1.5 inches or something of that sort, and that you're putting your distribution uniformly, how uniform the water is be putting out is assumed to be at least 80%. And those are all those numbers that I was mentioning earlier that you can calculate if you want to. But for the most part, that's a good system. If it's 80% or more, you're putting most of the water where it needs to be. A lot of us don't have irrigation systems that work that well. There's been some studies on some commercial irrigation sites as well as some homeowner things, and they could be as bad as 20%, meaning 60% of the water that goes to the system doesn't land where it's supposed to.
Wow.
It's not getting on the plant material. So that's going to be in the form of runoff, evaporation, whatever it is. That's why you really want to go back to that irrigation delivery system first before you do anything with the clock. Make sure that it's actually putting out water where it should.
So the first thing to do is to go to your sprinkler timer, find the manual switch.
Find the manual setting, yeah.
And press the manual setting and look at each of your stations.
Exactly. Go through and walk it. Look, and you're going to have to do that. This isn't like an annual thing. You can get away with maybe doing it annually, but I can tell you that things are going to happen. If you have a gardener or you are not great at mowing and you hit a sprinkler and you nick it or break it, you won't know that until the next time you turn it on. So what we do here at the research facility is the guys that I have that mow, I have them do the irrigation system right after that. And that they keep that together. So I'm mowing, and then right after that I'm going to run the system to make sure that I didn't nick anything or move anything or tilt any of the sprinklers by hitting them with the mower. That is their way of doing it. So they, during the summer, if they're mowing on a weekly basis, that's a check that's weekly done.
Wow.
That's a lot. Don't expect most homeowners to do that, but if you can, that's a great way to do it.
That is a good idea for those of us that have gardeners, though. I mean, at least we could ask them, once a month, first week of the month, to, after they mow, turn on the sprinkler system and make sure
exactly.
they didn't hit anything.
And it's a great opportunity for people to find out how much their gardeners know about irrigation.
Yeah.
A lot of times irrigation is, if it's green and it's growing, then everything must be good with irrigation. When you are an irrigator, we find in agriculture, your title is an irrigator and your job is to irrigate. So if you can imagine your job description is written as irrigating and keeping plants alive, you're not going to risk things not being irrigated or taking the irrigation down. So we have this change that we're seeing where we really are trying to educate provide more education to those irrigators that are responsible for that, because they have very important jobs. And I think that we need to understand and reward those people that do that.
Absolutely. I know. It also, though, behooves us individual homeowners, even though this might not be something that we've done in the past or that we're particularly comfortable doing. I know I've learned how to operate my timer, which, you know, a few years ago I never even looked at it. But as water's become more and more of an issue, and in my current home where I planted a lot of native stuff, knowing that the gardeners, you know, just basically want to make sure everything's getting plenty of water, wasn't working for the native plant palette, so that made me have to learn
how
to adjust certain stations in my yard. And it's actually not that hard. And I know when we are giving talks as master gardeners recently, one of the big things that we're encouraging people to do is to control their controllers. And so even if it's not something that you think that you really are talented at doing, it's not that hard. And I know a lot of people tell me, well, they don't even have the instructions, but we advise folks to just go out to your timer, copy down the manufacturer and the model number, and get on the internet, because if you Google that and get to the manufacturer's website and put in the model number, odds are you're going to be able to find those instructions.
And a lot of those manufacturers, some may charge, some may not. You can get on the phone and give them a call, and they will step you through the process if it's just too difficult. So
that
again, keep that in mind. Some of them do charge, just like any technology. I see them as, you know, there's so many different models, just like cell phones, and how many features do we really all use on all our cell phones? There's plenty that I know I don't use that I could be using. You just got to take the time to learn them. And most of them you realize, oh, yeah, that's going to be a good time saver. And the same thing with a lot of the clocks. A lot of settings on them can get very confusing very quickly. And so it's good to get some assistance.
It is. And I know I was totally intimidated by it, but I just sucked it up and stood there learned how to use, you know, three buttons. And that was, you know, how much time for each station, how many days a week to water it. And then this is the other thing I want you to talk about. How many cycles to do each time I do irrigate? So let's talk about the cycles.
So one of the cycling idea is for a couple reasons. Most of us all have different types of soil. Some of us have soils that are able to take water in very quickly. There are infiltration tests that can be done, and they're very much like sprinklers putting out. So I mentioned a sprinkler, if it puts out 1.5 inches in an hour, well, the soil can take in water at a certain rate as well. So if you're putting, if your soil only takes in 0.5 inch in an hour, and you're putting out 1.5 inches, in, you know you're going to get puddling, and if it's on a slope or run area, that water is just going to run off. So you need to kind of determine what the quick and dirty way to determine your infiltration of your soil is: dig a small hole and then just pour some water in it and take your watch and see how long it takes that water to infiltrate. And that gives you an idea. It doesn't have to be exact, again, for homeowners to get an idea of how quickly things will do it. And you can make adjustments to that. So if you have sprinklers that put out a lot of water, you're going to want to have shorter run times, and you basically turn it on, wait. If it takes 2 minutes or 5 minutes for runoff to occur, that's your run time, your first run time. Most likely 2 minutes or 5 minutes of a run time is not going to put that much water into your soil. And so my suggestion is to go back with, and I think everybody should buy a soil probe of some kind.
Absolutely.
You can use a screwdriver or something like that, but it's really nice to have a soil probe, which actually removes a soil core, so you can actually see how far the water's going down. So if you water for 5 minutes and then you pull a soil core out and there's only, you know, maybe 1/4 inch of the water has gone into the soil, you know that's not a long enough run time. And I want you to equate that with what the roots are going to see. If you water that 5 minutes every day and that's it, you may get a nice short root growth on your grass, if we're talking turf grass. But what the problem is going to be is if the water districts tell you, now, Kane, you can't water every day anymore. You're only going to be water twice a week. Well, that's not going to be enough water for those roots to survive. So what we really want to do is more infrequent waters, but deeper. And that promotes deeper root growth, and that's what we definitely want.
So people want to learn how to use that times per day setting on their
I much rather like to mess with how many days a week I'm going to water than how long I'm going to water. So if I want to always put 4 or 5 inches of water in my soil every time I irrigate, that's what I want to put there. Some days I don't want to put 1 inch, and some days 5 inches. I want to put that same amount. And so in the wintertime, that may be only once a week, or maybe once every 2 weeks, or maybe never because it's raining.
Right.
And then you can just shut off your clock from, you know, November to February. And that, we all hope that occurs in the next winter, that we can just all turn our irrigation off and let Mother Nature take care of it.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be wonderful. So that's really how you want to kind of mess with that. If
so
you can't
at least
do that,
two cycles, would you say, every time you irrigate?
And this is where it becomes complicated, and,
uh-huh.
and people don't like when I answer. So it really does depend. If you've got very sandy soil,
oh, there you go.
The water's going to move much quicker in there, and you're not going to want to run it over and over again because you're wasting water at that point. It's going way below the root zone.
So at my house where it's clay and
then,
slopey.
Right. Then you're going to have probably more cycles, but they're going to be shorter. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes people can have up to four or five cycles, but they're only like 2 or 3 minutes apiece.
Right, especially on a slope where it runs off really fast.
And you kind of want it to cycle through the rest of the system so that you're not putting on 2 minutes. You want to wait in between. So you put on for 2 minutes or 3 minutes, let it soak in, then come back maybe an hour later, do that again. And the clock can do that if it's programmed correctly.
Right. Or if you have, I have a fair number of stations at my house, so I just have it do it sequential. But because I have so many stations, it's...
By the time it gets around?
It is a while before it starts
again. And that's exactly
what
you want. Exactly what you want.
Well, good. So those are a couple of relatively easy things that people can do. They can put cycled irrigation on their timers.
Mm-hmm.
They can check all of their irrigation to make sure that there aren't any problems with the...
Right, so regular maintenance is critical.
And then... talk just a second about some of the other irrigation systems. If people do want to switch to, say, a native, very drought-tolerant pallet, would you recommend that if they have the budget and they are so inclined, would a different irrigation system be more efficient, drip or, the other low water usage?
So, yeah, I mean, one of the things we found in our landscapes is that every system has some advantages to it and some disadvantages to it. So what we did in our landscapes is I mentioned the soil moisture sensing devices in our retrofitted landscape. Works very well. I mean, there's some issues with it's a lot of wiring because those sensors have to be wired into the different zones in your landscape, and so you've got to be cognizant of that when you're out gardening, and if you're planting new plants, you can very easy cut
wiring
cables, and then it won't work anymore, and it'll be overwatering. But those systems are good because they're sensing the soil. One of the things you have to do with soil sensors is have to determine, okay, how deep do I put this soil sensor? Is it going to be, 4 or 5 inches deep where the turf grass roots may be, or should I put it 2 feet deep for a tree? And so that's why it's really important to kind of think about what plant material is in that particular zone, as well as try not to mismatch plant material. Putting a tree in a lawn makes things difficult.
Absolutely.
What do you irrigate for? And I think that's where a lot of people are going to have some issues with this drought, because you do have to cut water back, and you might have your prized tree that you've grown from a seedling, and it's just a beautiful shade tree for your house, and it's in the middle of the lawn, so it's got a very shallow root system because it's only been irrigated with your turf grass. That's going to be where people are going to have to focus some of their energies on just irrigating the tree to make sure that it gets enough and starts to really put down some deep roots. And so looking around the landscape, as you drive around, you're going to be seeing probably some trees that are going to be suffering because of that, their placement.
That's a really good point, because when folks are asking me, they say, I know that, we're going to have to let our lawn go, but what about these trees and these, beautiful, shrubs that we have are things I would like to retain, what do we do about that? What kind of irrigation can people do if they aren't going to retrofit their whole yard to preserve those trees and perhaps some other special plants?
So, I mean, one of the easiest methods would be to hand supplement those areas. If you have to turn off or decide to turn off your turf grass and you're just going to water the tree, then basically use a hose or some other method where you can just target that application of water that you're going to put on your trees and shrubs as well. I would say that probably the majority up until the last couple of years of urban landscapes tend to be over-irrigated.
Yes.
So even though we may be having to cut back significantly, people may find that they might not see much. It just really depends on what they were irrigating before their cutback was put forward. So one of the things I noticed during the downturn in the economy where some businesses were closing in some areas, or maybe they might have a very small landscape out front, it was amazing to me where the turf grass died very quickly in front of a store, but there were trees there and shrubs that went on for months without I'm sure the irrigation had been turned off because the lawn showed that. But because they had more deep root systems and had been over, irrigated so heavily, they probably were able to survive much better than we had thought.
So things
like privet and ficus, those things just did not seem to suffer until months and months, months later.
Well, I've even seen on houses that have, you know, been in foreclosure that the rose bushes are still going strong, you know.
Absolutely.
So it is interesting.
So a lot of our plant material that we've always thought of as being, you know, high water user or needing something every day really, really doesn't. Especially if it had been irrigated properly from planting and formed an extensive root. We do have to be very careful. Anything that's shallow rooted and just has not had the opportunity to do that, either because it was irrigated improperly with, you know, short amount of run times every single day, or maybe the soil was really heavy and it just was unable to penetrate deeper into the soil profile, that we're going to probably have some plant losses in that situation.
Right. I know the area I'm going to focus on in my yard is to save my trees, because those are such a huge investment.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
Yes,
so.
Absolutely.
And then the other area that I personally am going to allocate water to is, I'm a vegetable gardener.
Oh, absolutely.
And
yes.
So I'm going to allocate, you know, water to that. Speaking of that, though, in my particular situation, and I know in newer neighborhoods here in Irvine in particular, and probably other water districts as well, some of the newer neighborhoods have reclaimed water that's used in their landscape. Can you tell us, is the reclaimed water, I know that Governor Brown has mandated this 25% reduction statewide in potable or drinking water use.
That's correct.
Are there any restrictions on the reclaimed water use?
Currently, I'm not aware of any restrictions on the reclaimed water use. We're 100% reclaimed water here for all of our research as well as our plantings. Obviously, we have potable for potable water use, but everything else is reclaimed water, and we've been on that for going on 4 years. So there is definitely potential for utilizing that as a resource, and I think it is something that we absolutely should be considering for a lot of situations that it will work very well for. There's a lot of research going on now on the impact of using reclaimed water on especially salt-sensitive plants, because there usually are higher salt levels in reclaimed water, and some plants over time can suffer from that. But that's an active area of research that I know a lot of the people that I work with are looking at and looking for funding in order to do that work, because we see that as one reclaimed as being one of the main sources of water for us in the future, and we should be utilizing
absolutely
that.
Yeah. Are there you may know this, I haven't heard anything about it, but I know IRWD, which is the water district here in Irvine that services the research station, and I live in Irvine, so it's also my water district. Are there moves by other water districts to make reclaimed water available to their users?
I know of several, especially in Southern California. We're kind of the pioneers in that in that manner. In fact, I was at a meeting in Oregon a couple weeks ago talking to some people back east, a wholesale grower of nursery plants, and they were talking about supplying him with reclaimed. But they don't have any experience with it, so they're very apprehensive in switching over to that. But their water quality actually looks pretty good when I compare it to what we have to deal with. And I basically gave them the confidence and said, we've been doing it for a number of years. Our water district in Irvine Ranch Water Districts for many, many years, for decades, they've been using reclaimed. And so I think it's all about managing that irrigation properly, managing the salinity in the water properly. And what always does help us, once again, is though when we do get those good winter rains, that's basically how those salts are flushed out of the soil and downward, and that the plants respond well to that. If you have several years in a row of drought where we don't get that leaching or that flushing of the salts, the plants, you know, do start to slow their growth. They might have leaf edge burn and those type of things and might start to suffer a little bit. But I'm only seeing that in a few species, and I think with a little bit more research and some traditional breeding programs, we'll have more and more plants that are going to do well under those kind of conditions.
They'll be more salt resistant.
More salt resistant,
yeah,
exactly.
That's great.
And that includes food crops as well.
So when you irrigate your research crops here, your food crops, you irrigate those with reclaimed water also?
Yeah, all reclaimed water. We use very low-volume spray heads or underground drip tape. We've been very efficient for a number of years. On our irrigation, you know, just mainly because due to the cost. There's no sense in, you know, we do not flood irrigate or any of those methods that are previously used in areas where the water cost may be significantly lower.
So there's no problem using reclaimed water on food crops?
No. In fact, our water that we're supplied is tertiary treated, so it is one of the higher quality waters that's available. Again, you know, from the standpoint of human health, there's not an issue. There is some research being done on the personal care products or pharmaceuticals that might be in reclaimed water. And so we've had one study that's been completed, and I think it's close to being published that we'll have some information on that. But this research facility provides the opportunity for some of that work to be done because we don't have any other facilities that are being supplied currently with reclaimed water.
Oh, absolutely.
So this is a unique opportunity for UC to conduct some really nice research into that area.
And this is not directly related, but I know I do have folks ask me about using gray water.
Sure, yeah.
Can you just briefly, we just have a couple of minutes left, but
sure,
let me...
In fact, that's even a newer one for me. I will let you know that the University of California produces a number of outreach publications, and we are currently working with the Department of Water Resources to update some old ones from the drought of the 70s and 80s that need some refreshing. And then we also have created some new ones. And so one of the new ones, I think, will be some information on gray water use for residents.
Oh, good.
And that's a much-needed publication that we have. There are free publications available online. That information, I think, is something that's early on for us. There's a lot of good nonprofits that are out there doing work in this area, so you should be able to find some key information. My one caveat is just make sure you follow your local regulations. Contact your local water district or water provider and say, okay, can you give me some information on the regulations for using gray water in the landscape?
And how to collect it, I assume they
should
have
be able
regulations.
To provide, yeah. And this paper publication we have will have some basic information on systems to collect it, what you need, but also some of the regulatory language, some of the rules that you need to follow, what the water should be used on, what it shouldn't be used on. It is an area that I think there's needs a lot more research by a lot of universities need to kind of do some of that to see some of the concerns. You know, and the concerns are related to anywhere from the salts that might be in soaps to maybe pathogens that could be. And that's one reason why gray water is kind of at this point going to be shower sinks, washing machines. Washing machines is probably the easiest and probably the first place people should start. You don't like to see food products like kitchen and dishwasher because you could be exposing outside to human pathogens. And we don't want that.
Right.
And I just think there's obviously going to need to be some more work that's done, and there's going to be a lot of new technologies that will be created in the future here that will probably solve all those problems as well.
So the moral of the story for the public right now is to do your research and make sure that you follow any regulations.
Yeah, you really want to make sure that you're following your local. There are state guidelines that allow for the use of gray water, but there's always some local jurisdiction regulations that they want you to follow as well, whether it be an inspection, make sure you do it correctly, plumbing is correct, those kind of things. I think that it's definitely something that people should do, but you want to do it right.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I think we're going to wrap up and going to ask you to put your open up your crystal ball. We keep hearing about the El Nino, the ocean water is warmer. What's your prediction for this winter? Thoughts?
I had hoped it was going to be last year. I had heard those kind of early on type things. I will say that the weather we've been experiencing so far this summer has been a little bit different, with the high humidity and the systems coming up from Mexico. So, maybe I sure hope we get lucky. But one thing I want to keep in everybody's mind is we will be experiencing droughts like this again. If next year it rains and we get 20 inches more than we normally get, we still need to consider, how are we going to manage these when they occur in the future? And so it can be a controversial subject on, water costs and, as we save water, water costs may still go up. There's all that going on. But my feeling is trying to minimize my impact on the environment and my use of things. And if I can reuse water for whatever, even if it's not a monetary purpose, I'm just doing that for the good of doing that, I'll do that. And I suggest that people think about that as well.
Going forward, whether we get rain or not,
yes,
Let's preserve this resource.
Absolutely.
We do live in a semi-arid area.
We do. Absolutely. You have to keep that in mind.
Well, Darren, thanks so much for your time and all the great information.
You're very
really
welcome.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you for the invitation.
Sure.